Welcome to the On the Way to New Work podcast with
Michael Trautmann
and Christoph Magnussen. And it's again in English because we have the chance to meet Ryan Merchant from Dashlane.
The world's best password manager.
Exactly. So thanks for having us.
Great. Glad you're here.
We just entered the building and the first thing that we saw is Ryan using his fingerprint to open the door. So we are in a security company. So that's maybe important to tell. But give us a bit of background of yourself personally and what you do here, what the company does, but also you as a person.
Yeah. So I'm Ryan. I'm a senior manager here. I'm on the marketing team. I kind of handle essentially communications duties, tasks, pretty much a lot of marketing tasks that aren't on the paid channel. So paid advertising is kind of not my space, but everything else, I'm pretty much involved with. I've been at Dashlane over 5 years now. So one of the longer tenured employees here. We have about 130, 140 people on staff. Probably maybe 10 have been here longer than me, including the founders and CEO. I guess it's been a bit of an interesting journey into this space. You know, I was born and raised in Texas, kind of grew up thinking I wanted to go into government national security area, studied in school twice, I got 2 degrees in it, and then just kind of realized it wasn't my personality to be kind of in a big bureaucracy, so to speak. But I had a tech background. I used to code as a kid. I went to an elementary school in Dallas that was one of the, they called it a pace setter magnet school. So essentially, this is back in the early 90s, late 80s, what they would do was give us the technology first in the state of Texas, see what the kids like, see how we did with it, and then they would deploy it across the state. So I was introduced to technology at a really young age. This is back when, you know, digital cameras were the size of probably biology textbooks and they took 2 pictures. But that was my introduction. I kind of always fashioned myself as an early adopter. You know, a bunch of friends and I, we were some of the first users on Napster.
Cool.
We were in that space really early on. So I've always kind of been at the forefront of that. And then kind of coming out of school professionally, you know, I managed a U.S. congressional campaign here in the States. Like I said, I was involved in politics, went back to graduate school here in New York at Columbia, kind of for the same thing. And then just realized I just didn't want to be in that world. So I kind of had to pivot out and I was kind of looking at my skill set and personal interests. And I'm like, you know, I don't like wearing a suit and tie. I like to wear my jeans and Nikes every day with a bunch of, you know, laid back people who are high achievers and like to do big things. So I was like, the tech space is kind of the fit. I didn't really have any tech skills. So I fashioned and repurposed the skills that I built on the political campaign. I did a lot of the marketing there, the acquisition, the PR, and applied to hundreds of jobs. Didn't get any of them. And then one day I got an email back for a company I applied to called fab.com. From the woman who would become my boss. And she said in her email, she's like, you know, I have about 500 applications for this job. She's like, you don't have a background in e-commerce. You don't have a background in startup or technology. She's like, why would you apply and waste my time? So I kind of just told her what I told you guys, what my interests are, what I wanted to do. As fate would have it, she actually had a similar background and went to similar schools. And so it was almost a mirror of her experience. And so, it's a bit of luck, but I like to think you create your own luck because it was an arduous process. Like I said, I was applying to hundreds of jobs and I almost didn't apply for it, but I just kind of kept going. So I worked at fab.com for about a year. It was a hellacious experience. At the time, they were the fastest growing startup in the world. We got to 1 million users faster than any company in history. That includes Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. The company raised hundreds of millions of dollars. It was ultimately a failure. For a variety of reasons, it's probably an entirely different podcast. So I spent a year there and then I was burnt out, went away to Florida and Miami for a few months just to recoup, get my sanity back. And then, you know, ended up applying to Dashlane in probably the beginning of 2013 and been here ever since. It's been quite a journey. I think, you know, personally, you know, I've liked it. It's amazing to see a company grow from, you know, we had, I think, probably 15 people in Paris at the time and maybe 4 of us in New York. And now, you know, we're doing partnerships and working with the largest tech companies in the world. We're a leader in the space. So it's been an incredible ride. It's gone by quickly.
Wow. What did you learn from we don't want to hear the full story because, as you mentioned, it could be another podcast. But what did you learn at FAB?
Yeah, that's a great question. you know, what they did was they started out as a social network site for gays, and the social network didn't have much traction, but they had a deal of the day that was just doing great, like amazingly well. They pivoted and decided to do a flash sale site and were just executing really well. And they were selling these niche items that would be, let's just say, like 100 handcrafted phone cases that people would go crazy for. And they would sell all these items, and just people were gobbling them up, and they would sell shirts, all kinds of cool stuff. But the problem was kind of inventory. They couldn't get people to come back and make repeat purchases. I think there, you know, we were also kind of operating when you're at breakneck speed. I mean, you're going so fast and you're seeing yourself, you know, New York Times, Bloomberg is like the fastest growing company in the world. You're just inundated with problems that you don't really envision. You're scaling too quickly. You're spending way too much money on way too many things. You're expanding into markets. You know, we did an acquisition in Germany. We did an acquisition in the UK really quickly, just out of fear that local competitors were going to come in and eat up the business. And e-commerce and flash sales at that time, this would be probably 2013. That was really what was hot in tech, in the tech world. A variety of lessons. I mean, I think it's, you know, accurate metrics is one. You need to be honest with your reporting, your numbers. You need to see where you're growing, where you're spending, number one. And then doing less with more, you know, just because you have the capital and you're growing doesn't mean you need to spend and create the world's biggest team. There was a lot of ego involved too, kind of at the top from the founders. They were a bit on an ego trip. I think they felt important, and it kind of clouded their judgment on some issues. But an amazing team. I mean, you look at where everybody ended up from there. I mean, you have people working at eBay in leadership roles at Walmart, people who've started their own companies. Our CFO here has actually worked with me at Fab, and he came a few years after I did. Actually, we've had two Fab employees here. But a great team. It's almost like a football comparison to where you were undefeated into the season and everybody's ego is riding high and you're like, we haven't lost, we can't be beat. And then you end up playing, you know, a small team and maybe a cup challenge or the Champions League from some random country you've never heard of. And then you lost 4-0 and everyone's like, how is this possible? We didn't lose. That's a bit what it felt like.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Amazing story. I mean, it's thanks for sharing the insights and learnings. And I would be curious to learn how you live it here, because we just looked at the values that you shared, and there's like transparency and also raise the fucking bar. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you live that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, how do you see it here, and what do you apply it, and how does Dashlane feel?
Much better. My blood pressure is down. I'm less stressed out than I was compared to Fab. I think it kind of, again, starts at the top with leadership. You know, our CEO is very transparent, our founders as well. You know, they don't have much of an ego. A lot of times you encounter people in this space, especially in the US tech space, that, you know, they just think they're God's gift to earth. They think they're the greatest thing ever because they've created a company. Maybe they went to Stanford Business School. And they don't want to hear any feedback, and they get this tunnel vision. That's not really present here. I think we hold each other accountable, like you were saying, very transparent. You know, if people leave or depart, there will be a company-wide a clear explanation as to, like, you know, why they're leaving, what happened. I think that, you know, we look at the numbers, the metrics. You guys kind of saw our dashboards as well.
Very
they're
open.
There for everybody to see. Our executive team, which is our C-level leadership, meets weekly on the Mondays. Those notes are shared company-wide, so everybody can see the minutes of the meeting and what was happening there. So I think it helps foster a bit of team spirit as well. Like, you feel connected. You don't just feel like, hey, I'm here on the sales team. What is going on over here on the other team? Kind of, I guess, builds a more cohesive unit.
How do you share that stuff internally?
I mean, we have a variety of, like, tools we use. We use the Jira Confluence platform for kind of system management internally. That's kind of where everything is based. We use Slack as a chat channel. That's been invaluable. It can get a bit overwhelming because you have so many chats going and there's so many rooms. But I'd like to be over communicated with. I'd rather just read too much than not be aware that, wow, we're launching something tomorrow and I had no idea that was happening. As you saw, like our screens in Paris, we have these two giant screens and the main rooms of both our New York office and Paris office that are always live streaming one another. So even if you're not there, you're actually seeing the team there. All of our meetings are video meetings, so you're seeing the person that you're communicating with. There's also a lot of travel that happens back and forth between the offices. Most people, when they onboard and start, are going to go to Paris or they're going to come to New York to meet the key people on their team, just so you get a little bit of face-to-face time. But again, you know, there's challenges with it being an international company like that. But I think, you know, given the speed at which we work and the challenges that we're tackling as a business, I think we do a pretty good job of it.
Mm-hmm. And your background, you mentioned in the very beginning, you're a music guy. There's a music background. We saw the meeting rooms have names.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So we were moving into this new office here in the Flatiron District of New York from a smaller office in Soho. And our CEO, you know, part of transparency, he let the New York team name the rooms. Mm-hmm. So we proposed these kind of stereotypical New York names like Empire, Big Apple. And his feedback was, he's like, this is just way too fucking corporate. Like, we're not going to have that. And so I think I was like, well, you know, one room was really big, one room was small. And we have the rapper from New York, Biggie Smalls, I'm a fan of. So I said, well, we just call it Biggie Smalls. And those stuck. And then we're in our second office right now, kind of in the same building. And for that one, we actually had a company-wide poll to choose the names. I forget what our CEO proposed. He proposed two, I think, it may have been French singers, I can't remember, to name the rooms here. And then some of the other employees in New York proposed these very strange names from the rap group Outkast called Aquemini and Spotiati Dopalicious, which are very hard to say, particularly for our French friends across the pond. And it was a very heated contest, and I may have had a part in influencing people to vote for the Outkast names at the end of the election, but we'll leave that for another show.
You have this, you have New York, you have Paris. Paris is very special. So I started my career in a French consulting company. I really enjoyed it, but it's special. How do you manage these two different cultures from the national background?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it kind of started at the beginning. I think when you're starting a company, like building your early team and building the foundation of the culture is really important. Our founders did a great job of hiring early on. So they got people who were just kind of culturally aware and didn't have an issue working across cultures, across languages. We still do a really good job of hiring. Like, I can't say, you know, there've been very few people that have just been very bad apples or like, you know, how the hell did this guy get here? So we do it. We have a great hiring process. So, you know, we're screening, but we're also giving you information so you know what you're dealing with. A lot of it depends on the teams too. So there are some teams where almost all of their work is going to be together and they're constantly chatting. Other people aren't going to be working together as closely. I mentioned those big screens. I think those are tremendously helpful to get past the cultural barrier you mentioned. It's one thing if I see your name all the time. It's another thing if I see your face and see you move. And then I guess on a bigger level, the world is getting smaller. I mean, and I say it as the American, but like English is kind of the de facto language of the world now. Everyone there speaks it. Most Americans don't speak anything else, unfortunately. It's not needed, but it's not that hard. I mean, even some of our user support people and contractors that we have in other countries around the world, I mean, everybody's communicating. Even in Paris, I don't have a percentage, but a large number of the people working there aren't French nationals, they're EU nationals. And I think that kind of adds to the international culture where it's just, you know, we're all from different places. Even in New York, most of the people here aren't born and raised in New York. You know, in my corner, I'm from Texas. We have a girl from Georgia, another girl from North Carolina, someone else from California, someone else from Boston. So you get people from all these different parts of the United States. So it's not just like a bunch of born and raised kind of people from, you know, Brooklyn, New York or Silicon Valley types. You're coming with a really diverse set of backgrounds and skills.
You work in an area that is becoming more and more important. I mean, like, part of our business in my company is that we also explain our customers that you cannot just collaborate for the sake of collaboration. They usually want a tool and they think that it all helps. I always explain you need to change the people, teach them how to collaborate, but there's also the security part of it.
Yeah.
Because with transparency, there comes a tremendous amount of responsibility and how to handle that, especially yes. user data, passwords. And I'm quite surprised that people still kind of handle their passwords as something, I don't know, I would never leave my passport on the desk somewhere laying around, leaving my home, leaving the key in front of the door and stuff like that. And it feels like people do that with their passwords, which is their online life. Mm-hmm. How does that evolve? How did it change? Because you're at the forefront.
Yeah,
maybe you give us some bad examples like the one you told us before.
Yeah.
I mean, there are, I guess it never ceases to surprise me. I've been here 5 years, and I think it's a matter of convenience, particularly, especially for American users, American, I guess, consumers in general. We've found, and anecdotally, and I think even in some of the data, German audience, Germany has a much different approach to security and privacy than the U.S. does. France and the UK, those are kind of our core four markets. The UK kind of skews a little more towards the US. France is kind of somewhat aligned with Germany, but still kind of more towards the US. I think people just want to access their information easily. We've gotten so spoiled and lazy with speed. You know, we all have our iPhones out here on the desk. I can press a button. I can order some new shoes, new clothes, a flight to Berlin, as well as a pizza that will be here in 30 minutes. In about 2 minutes of scrolling on my phone. So our brains have become wired to convenience. We don't think about security. We think about, I need to log into my email. I need to access this. So we get these ridiculous passwords. We released a study yesterday in partnership with Virginia Tech University. A computer science professor there shared a list of 61 million passwords that have been breached.
Wow.
We went through and analyzed it, and you're looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, most common password. Password, second most common password. You're looking at Barcelona, a common password, sports team. You're looking at American football team's name, Superman. And it never ceases to astonish me. So I think, to your point, it's a matter of convenience. People are just lazy. For us, the point we reiterate a lot of times in the media, in my role, the question I get and I got yesterday from journalists around the world is, what's the best password? Yeah. What's the most secure password? I say, take a step back. It's not about secure passwords. It's about password reuse. Because you could have the most secure password in the world. And we found from our own data, the average user has 150 accounts that require passwords. You're reusing that super strong password, every account, all it takes is one site to get hacked. Mm-hmm. Your data's gone. So password reuse is the main culprit. But most people are using the same thing.
I explain something that is not too obvious to many people, like password managers, like you guys have that. You usually have a feature that lets you generate a password.
Yep.
And when I'm asked how long is a good password, or like how does a good password look like, and people then answer like 8, and then you need to have letters and numbers, I usually say it's bullshit. The only thing is size matters. So the longer, the better. Mm. And the password manager lets you have a password that is like 30 letters long and stuff like that. Stuff that you usually cannot remember.
Yeah.
And maybe you just give a little glimpse into like why it's more secure, because some people are then afraid if that massive password is hacked, then, but it's...
Yeah. I guess the core of the password manager is essentially it's a system that manages all your passwords. So you access it with a master password. The great thing about us is we have what's called a zero knowledge architecture, which means we don't store your master password anywhere. That's by design, because obviously, if a hacker gets into our server, they get the master password. They get all of your passwords, credit card numbers. So we don't know it at all. You only know it. And that's how you get into your passwords. Once you're in the manager, you can store all your passwords. There's a generator in there. And then you can pick and choose the length. Some sites are going to require a number or a symbol. And then we'll automatically generate the password. We'll store it for you on your device locally, whether it's a PC, whether it's a mobile phone, Mac or whatnot. And then when you try to log into the site, we're going to automatically log you in with your secure login, your secure password. So me, I have, I think my last count was 586 accounts in Dashlane, and I have 586 different passwords. I honestly don't know any of them, and I'm able to access everything and feel fine. And that's by design. That's how it works. We also have a great breach alert service. So if there is a breach, we'll push an alert to you that says, hey, this site has been hacked. Change your password immediately so you know you need to change it. And then that alert, you know, will show you kind of in the future that, hey, this site was breached. Your password's at risk because you also reuse it on these sites as well. Going back to the first point about password reuse.
And what Michael just mentioned is like we're moving to the next level of security because, for example, cameras become way better. And when you like did the fingerprint, you said, but don't take a picture of my fingerprint.
Yes.
And you gave this example from Germany.
Yes, I think it was about 4 years ago at a security conference. Hackers were able to, I think, get inside the German Defense Ministry because they had a high-res photo of the German Defense Minister's finger and were able to take that the shot of the fingerprint and then use that biometric information to access the system. And I give that example because a lot of folks in the security world will always argue that biometrics are the future, that it, whether it be a voice, whether it be, you know, an eye scan or a fingerprint. Our response to that is biometrics are kind of a side benefit. They kind of support passwords because you only have two eyes, right? If your retina scan is hacked, you're not going to be able to replace your retina. You have one voice. Unless you go in and alter your vocal cords, you can't replace the voice. You only have 10 fingers. If someone has all your fingerprints, then, you know, you're out of options there at the, you know, I guess that's the 13 options that you have. So I think biometrics are great to support passwords. You know, Bill Gates, we gave a great presentation our CEO did at the Web Summit several years back about why the password won't die. There's a great quote from Bill Gates. I want to say maybe it's 10 or 15 years ago, the password is dead. It's about to die. And we're like, it's not going anywhere. You know, if you look at how much cash Apple has in the bank, how much cash Google has, Microsoft, these companies haven't solved the password problem. And if they do, it's only going to work on their ecosystem, right? If Apple creates a great security or password authentication process, Google isn't going to adopt it. Microsoft isn't going to adopt it. So what about those accounts? I think that's kind of how we approach the broad problem. That's why we've kind of designed it to work everywhere on Android phones and on iPhones, on PC, on Mac, on Linux, because it has to be kind of cross-platform. I'm a Mac guy, so I have an iPhone. I have MacBook Pros at home. At work, I'm using a PC. So my work solution wouldn't work at home, and my home solution wouldn't work at work. But Dashlane, thankfully, it works everywhere. So that's I think that's the biometric example. Thank you to the German hackers, although I don't want the Ministry of Defense hacked again. But it kind of shows the limitations of biometrics.
Interesting. We're moving into an interesting future because I've just thought about this morning, like my kids, my daughter is 3, my son is like almost a year old, and they grew up entirely in a fully photographed, video recorded world. And the quality has become so good. And if you just mention that now, like say, most likely it's possible, like when you said that with the picture and the fingerprint, I'm like, okay, it's obvious, it makes perfect sense, but like where are we moving? I have no answer, and it's hard to tell.
Maybe we dig a little bit deeper into the security aspect. You mentioned the example that your president Donald Trump uses two iPhones which are not secure, and that it is able for a medium talented hacker to hack him. How can this happen?
Yeah, I think the report came out yesterday, a number of outlets here, that he wasn't patching his phone. He wasn't updating like we all do when we get the update. It says update to security. Clearly, he likes to tweet all times of day or night. I think if you go back to the previous administration, Barack Obama wanted to keep his BlackBerry with him. And he had a long kind of drawn out battle with the Secret Service and the NSA. Division of the NSA that's responsible for the presidential electronics. They essentially created a special phone for him, a secure phone that he could use. And I think it could only dial set numbers. He couldn't access apps or anything on it. And then they gave similar phones to 20 approved contacts of his. And he went along with it. It was fine. There's no security incidents that we know of. From what I've heard both in the news and anecdotally for some friends in DC is that the current president has kind of pushed back against that continually. He says it's not convenient for him. It's too much of a hassle. But I mean, as we've known, just from any kind of, you know, probably the 30 most advanced countries in the world in terms of cybersecurity offensive capabilities, it's not that difficult to deliver software that enables them to just lurk on the phone. We know at least the NSA has capabilities to listen when a device is fully off, to track a device when it's fully off. So, you know, I'm assuming that state actors out there, probably some non-state elements as well, have that capability to in theory, I think, just live on the phone and listen to the conversations of the President of the United States for 24 hours, which is truly terrifying. I think I, you know, if someone did that, a competitor did that for Dashlane to my phone, they would learn a lot of things. It would be very, very useful. Yeah. And that's just for Dashlane. And we're talking about the most powerful man in the world. Bit concerning, but again, you know, it reflects the, what you were mentioning earlier about this lackadaisical attitude towards security.
Yeah.
It's just about convenience.
What do you expect from the future? It will get worse. I mean, there will be more attacks, more hackers, more.
Yeah.
More attempts to.
I've become paranoid at Dashlane. I told a friend I liken it. I was like, imagine you worked for a police unit for 5 years, and all you did was investigate home burglaries, and you've seen every type of way someone is going to break into a house imaginable, and it will probably make you really paranoid about your house. You're probably going to have bars on the windows. The chimney's going to be boarded up. You're going to have motion sensors, cameras, just because you've seen every way it can happen. And kind of being behind the scenes here at Dashlane and getting into the weeds of a lot of these breaches and seeing how prevalent they are and talking to, you know, the chief security officers at a lot of big companies and seeing just how vulnerable they are. And these are big companies that have all of our data. And I think the danger is it's just not that hard. Like we could do a search on YouTube or Google and the three of us, even if we don't have great technical skills, you know, we can deliver some malware today that's pretty effective. You know, there's apps that are readily available that you can just push it, send you a text message, you know, and then boom, I'm recording your text conversations. Admittedly, I'm a bit paranoid about it. I think I monitor what I write, what I put out there now. I mean, you think about we casually send statements or we send messages, and I think all of us are guilty of making bad jokes or, you know, politically incorrect statements with our friends, with our relatives. We all do it. But, you know, someone screenshots that, puts it out there, your professional career in life may be over because
Absolutely.
Of it.
Yeah.
I think even, I guess that's a bit above the security, but I think it's just to where we are as a culture in terms of privacy that it just completely changes. I think the social media, I call it the social media mob, you know, it's trial by social media now. You know, 10, 20 years ago, you know, you did something wrong, even in the press, it'll kind of play out over a matter of weeks and like, what did he do? What happened? Now, oh, you know, Ryan said X, Y, and Z. Here's the screenshot. Oh my goodness. Like this man is terrible. The danger in that is that now someone can artificially create that screenshot. I never said it or texted it, put it out there, and then I'm done. You know, there was a case a few months back. I forget the name of it, but essentially people were taking celebrity faces and superimposing them into pornography and porn actors. They were doing an incredible job with it. Like if you casually walked by the video, you would think it was them. And the implications for that are immense, particularly not just in the world of pornography, but politics, business leadership. You know, if I'm a politician and someone can create a video of me saying something that I didn't say, your campaign is done in a day.
There's a great video from this guy called Fusion explaining deep fakes.
So yes, that's
really
what it is. Yeah.
Really good deep fakes, and it's scary to see.
Terrifying.
What's happening. And we Michael knows that at Blackboard sometimes we challenge clients and tell them, you know, it's so easy to fake your email address and you trust it 100%, especially as a managing director. You usually get a lot of mails. And then the IT guy say, yeah, but that's not hacking, like using the mail address. Mm-hmm. But like a first grade IT student can do that. It's very easy. And we trust that medium. And Where I'm heading, you're thinking about that. I have no answer to that, but there is a next generation coming, growing up with that, as I said, trusting all these mediums. And I'm thinking sometimes we all talk about transparency in companies, and it's getting more and more transparent, everything we do. So I'm always thinking of like, are certain things getting more accepted because they're transparent? Do people become more critical, saying like, yeah, this is social media, you cannot believe it anyways? I don't know. I just can say, when I watched the movie on the flight here, what's it called in English, about the Washington Post? Die Verlegerin in German.
What is it? The Post. I think it's called The Post.
Yeah. It's an awesome movie, and it shows so much. Yeah. It shows so much about like where we started and where we had to, like, back then. This was a security breach. Mm-hmm. Today we say like, yeah, this is all transparent information. Come on.
Yeah.
Is that like what do you see from the security side? Would you see it's going to like a full transparency in terms of information? Can we even stop it? Is it possible to stop? Like,
I think we're trying to chase our shadow with it. The technology is always going to be 5 to 10 years ahead of where the policies are going to be, right? Like right now we're trying to institute policies for the 2008, 2012 technology. It's 2018, you know, and it doesn't take much. I mean, think about just the apps that are on your phone. Many of these did not exist a few years ago, some even months ago, and they transform the way you're working and operating. I monitor what I put out there. Like I'm not a big social media guy. I was actually, my school was one of the first schools on Facebook. So they added us probably late 2003, early 2004. And initially my school, how Facebook worked, which many listeners may not know because they just got Facebook at a later stage and Facebook is Facebook, is it worked in American universities. It was the Ivy League and a few other elite colleges that they had. So there were about 15 schools that were on. You could only access your school's network and you could only get on with an .edu address, which
that's
is
what
an
we
educational
learned yesterday
domain.
First. I didn't know it. Yeah.
And it was great. I saw the virality in it the first week, you know, I was on. You know, my university had about 6,000 students in it. First week, there were about 300 of us on. Week two, there were probably 1,500. By the end of the month, almost the entire school was on it. And you could only access and friend request your friends. And then you could limit who saw your board. And then even as it grew, you couldn't get to other schools. And at the beginning, it was just these kind of elite American universities, which a bit of a snob, but it was kind of nice. Like it was a very limited network. And you were essentially saying, hey, where's this party going to be at school? Where's an event going to be at? Here's the basketball game photos. And then it just blossomed to the beast that it is now, and everything is on there. And I mean, I went through during the whole Cambridge Analytica scandal, looked at my data. I mean, I hadn't been using it actively since about 2008. And that's just because there's so much out there. You know, your parents, your grandparents are on there. You know, we put so much information. I think, you know, again, going back to the first things we said, it's about convenience and people just want to put it out there. They want to feel important. You get a little dopamine rush too, you know. It's like, oh, wow, 20 like 25 likes. Wow, I only have 30 friends and everybody likes it. It really plays with kind of the chemistry of your brain in a way that I don't think many people think about. And I think even, you know, social media like Instagram now, I mean, in New York, it's one of the things that just drives me crazy. Obviously, we have a lot of tourists here. And people have always taken pictures in New York. You know, I went to school here. I've lived in Washington, D.C., Miami, like tourist places. People are always going to take pictures. But now you walk through the streets and people are, you know, we call it in English, doing it for the gram, which is just these like unnatural poses in front of objects that they're clearly putting on Instagram and filtering. And you see it everywhere. And I'm like, yeah, we're not in the moment. Like, you know, I hate when I travel to somewhere nice and extreme. It's like, wow, I spent, you know, 14 hours on the plane to get here. Wow, this is a beautiful waterfall or something. I'm going to watch the waterfall. I'm going to smell it. I'm going to taste it, enjoy it. But now it's like, what do you have? 80 people there. Everybody's trying to take the picture, posting it immediately. And it's all about the gratification, making up a word, satisfaction that you get from that, you know, the likes or whatnot.
Kurze Zeit zum Durchatmen. Ein Tipp von unserem Werbepartner Blinkist. Das ist eine App, die 2500 internationale Sachbuch-Bestseller auf eine App gebracht hat. Dort könnt ihr euch das Wissen von großartigen Büchern in 15-Minuten-Blöcken runterziehen als Soundfile oder zum Lesen auf Englisch, auf Deutsch, aus den unterschiedlichsten Bereichen. Karriere, Ratgeber, Meditationsguide, Biografien, also alle Sachbücher, die ihr schon immer lesen wolltet, die vielleicht in einem Stapel auf eurem Nachttisch über sich hinaus wachsen. Ihr schafft es nicht mehr, kommt nicht mehr hinterher. Mit dieser App könnt ihr wirklich dann für euch klären, wo wollt ihr tiefer eintauchen und was wollt ihr vielleicht ganz lesen. Aber ich kann euch versprechen, ihr habt jetzt ein paar Wochen in der Anwendung. Das Allermeiste könnt ihr dort wirklich aus dieser App rausziehen. Ich habe zum Beispiel meinen Lieblingsklassiker, die 7 Habits, also die 7 Wege zur Effektivität von Stephen Covey, den ich früher immer mal wieder ganz gelesen habe. Den kann ich mir jetzt einmal im Monat anschauen, um auf dem Pfad zu bleiben. Wirklich nur 15 Minuten pro Titel lesen oder anhören. Und das Allerbeste, wir haben eine ganz tolle Aktion, exklusiv für die Hörer unseres Podcasts. Und auf blinkist.de/newwork erhaltet ihr 25% Rabatt auf das Jahresabo Blinkist Premium. Es gibt natürlich auch ein Probeabo, bei dem ihr alles kostenlos testen könnt, aber das Premium-Abo, ich habe selber, kann ich euch nur empfehlen. Also Blinkist, nicht Blinklist, sondern Blinkist. Blinkist.de/newwork, 25% Rabatt. I have two sons, 22 and 19, and the younger one, when he was 16, 17, he did an internship in our New York office, and we lived in Soho, office was in Midtown, and we decided to walk every morning, and then he's not talking too much, so, but when he says something, it's meaningful. So, and one day, 15 minutes, no conversation, they said, Daddy, I said, yes, I think you post too much on social media. I said, okay. What do you mean, too much? Yeah, it's just too much. And 5 minutes later, I asked him, what do you think would be correct? Once a week? And I really said, okay. And then there were the situations where we had beautiful things where we see. And he says, Daddy, just try to see it with your heart, but don't take a picture of it or anything. You will remember it very well if you really, I mean, a 16-year-old boy, and he really made me think. And I am, my colleagues, they call me New York's toughest street photographer.
Yes, but you have a good eye.
Yeah, but I really can see my son in you, and I think it's absolutely correct. We do it too much, and
let's stick with that, because I know you quite well, and it's an interesting example, because you changed that a lot, like from taking picture for the sake of taking a picture. You see a situation that other people don't see in that moment, and when I see the picture that you took, I say like, wow, I didn't see that. So to me, there's a difference between using that as a tool and then using this as an object to like present something, and I can feel that if I'm not in the middle, like with me, I cannot deliver that. Yeah. Same with the video, same with the conversation, with the talk, whatever. And what I'm worrying about is more this everyone taking pictures of everything. So I see certain people like taking kids' pictures, for example, not seeing the situation as it is, but just holding from up front and taking pictures for the sake of that. And that's a difference. To me, that's a difference.
Yeah. Well, the kids thing is another interesting point. I don't have kids. If I did, young children, I wouldn't post the pictures publicly. I see that relatives do it. I see celebrities do it. And it's just you're setting yourself up for some bad scenarios. Like, number one, their privacy. Even if nothing bad happens, all these pictures are out there. Like, everybody knows who they are, where they're at. And again, you know, the photography, it kind of reminds me of an example here in New York. I think it was during, you know, like Fashion Week, and there was some model who, you know, a friend showed me her picture, and she posted from her hotel room in New York, just a photo of like the New York skyline from her hotel room. And I saw that, and I looked at it. I'm like, I know exactly that where that hotel is by the street below. I know where you're staying. I know that the building across the street is 6 stories high. I now know you're on the 7th story. I can align that with the building across the street and know exactly which room you're in. And you're posting pictures of yourself wearing hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of jewelry, and your children are there, and like other celebrities are there. You know, it's not that hard for me to get access to that.
It happened to Kim Kardashian in Paris.
Kim Kardashian,
Yeah. It, super. But you know, even high profile people, you know, you're posting in your cars. Okay, I can see you're driving that, you know, that Audi right now. Cars are very hackable. There's computer systems in there. Even regular people, like, you're posting your vacation. Well, if it's public, you know, and I'm, let's say I'm looking to rob a nice neighborhood in New York, and I'm just looking at geotagged photos from that neighborhood, I can identify who's publicly there. I can get your name, where you work at, just follow you. And now I know, oh, you're going away to Italy for 2 weeks. Your husband isn't there and your kids are all posting from Italy as well. Don't think there's anybody in that house. It's a great place to target. Is that paranoid? A little bit, but it's still, you know, I think it's better to think about that than the alternative. I think it's better to be conscious about all the data you put out there, what you tweet. You know, my dad does some work with professional athletes here in the United States, in the National Football League. And he always tries to tell these guys, you know, like, I know you get emotional, but like, you know, take your finger off the trigger of the tweet button. Just think about it. You know, you have 100,000, a million followers. Like, think about it for a second. It can wait a day, right?
Yeah.
Is there anything, on Instagram that we post that can't be posted tomorrow or that we can't tweet tomorrow? Is there anything so important, you know, other than, you know, North Korea firing a missile and Trump maybe tweeting, don't shoot, we'll meet, you know, other than that crazy scenario, you know, is there anything that can't just wait another day? Like, do I, you know, I'm going, well, I won't say where I'm going on vacation for security reasons, but going somewhere soon, you know, does that photo have to get posted right as I get there? Can it wait a week? Does the vacation not happen if I don't post it? I had some friends a while back, you know, we were talking, forgot where I went. I think it may have been actually to Paris for work, and I took a side trip. I forgot. And it was great. I think we went outside in the countryside and saw some cool things. It was great. And like, a friend of mine was legitimately doubtful that that trip occurred. He's like, oh, you don't have any pictures of it. I'm like, we live in the age now where there's no pictures that did not happen. People will question you. It's like, if you guys didn't post pictures of this trip and, you know, podcast hadn't gone out yet, it's like,
didn't happen.
It didn't happen. You still emailed me. I still got your text on time. Did the trip happen?
Crazy. Yeah. Let's step back to the experience at FAB, if you may allow us to ask this question. You said in one sentence that you were close to a burnout. What do you do now better to never get you into such situation? How do you organize yourself? How do you have routines, rituals for your day?
Yeah, I think there it was almost impossible. I think, you know, when you have, you know, bad leadership, bad management and a stressful work environment and unrealistic demands put on you, you're just set up for failure. You know, I did the best that I could there. But it was just inescapable. I think in the year that I was there, I took 5 days of vacation the entire year for the Thanksgiving holiday and the Christmas holiday. Usually I go back home to Texas. My parents had to fly to New York both times. We were technically allowed to go home, but it was kind of understood that like you need to be in New York. You know, I guess the best anecdote that I have just to kind of highlight what it was like when Hurricane Sandy hit here, I think it was 2012, you know, power was knocked out to lower Manhattan. My power was out, you know, had my girlfriend at the time was staying at me. Her power was out. A friend of theirs was stuck because he couldn't fly back home. And I'm like, you know, all right, we need to get like electricity. It's a safety issue. Like what's going to happen? And I remember getting like these angry emails, kind of from the leadership basically saying, it's hard to describe the geography of New York, but they wanted me to essentially walk from my home about an hour and a half northwest to the CEO's apartment and work remotely from there all week long. So walk an hour and a half, work a full day, walk an hour and a half back. And I was like, you know, we're trying to fly people back home. We're trying to make sure people are safe. That's kind of what the environment was like. Now, it's just a much better culture. We kind of in the U.S., on the U.S. side, have unlimited vacation days. Which you end up not taking as many as you expect, but we have a pretty flexible work from home policy at Dashlane. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a couple of weeks back, I had an issue with the gas stove that I have at home. I can just stay home, wait for the repairman to come, work remotely, and it's not a big issue. We have our video conferencing so everybody can dial into the meetings. Even if I'm remote, I can dial into the room. You have to go to the dentist or the doctor. It just takes that stress off because we all have lives outside of work. You know, you guys have kids. It's like, oh, I have to go pick my kid up. They're sick. people work from home when their kids are ill. That makes a world of difference. Just having that element removed. Personally, I try to take 2 week vacations and 2 week stretches. I used to do the traditional American. I'll take 5 days and but I realized, you land, you kind of are there, then you're worrying about getting back. I found that 2 weeks, you disconnect. I've made it a habit, to travel to places that are far flung and don't have the strongest internet connections. So I'm completely offline. Good. I went to Africa a few years ago and was like, here's what to do if something breaks, if something happens, you will not be able to reach me, which was great. I mean, it actually is a complete refresh because you don't want to be sitting in the mountains or, skiing or on a beach and checking Dashlane emails while I'm trying to relax. That's my main thing. Mm-hmm. I guess my routine, people here think it's a bit crazy. I'm an early riser, so I go to the gym very early before work, get a workout in, and then I'm usually in the office very early.
What is very early for you?
Oh, man. Oh, I won't even say it. My parents may hear this and they're going to be like, Ryan, you need to sleep. But
we rise early. So
it's 5 o'clock in the morning.
And I'm 4:30. So we're, is it early?
We know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
Those are great hours to rise. I'll say that. I'm usually in the office about 7.
Oh,
that's very German. That's, hey, come on.
That's the mother side.
In my last company, that was definitely time. Not for the marketing team, though, I have to say, for the production side.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
But I like it because I get here and I guess another benefit is we have flexible hours. So everyone isn't here at 9. It ranges from me being here at 7 to some people getting in at 10:30 or 11. I like it because I get here, the arrival order, it's usually me. It's usually our CEO comes in right after me, which is great because a lot of times I'll need to work with him on issues. And so I get all of my answers right at the beginning of the day.
That's cool.
And can just proceed without having to get in the backlog that he has. The same with our CMO who gets here early as well. And then most people probably arrive about 9:30. So I have about 2.5 hours of just quiet, uninterrupted work. And I'm already in the flow of the workday. I've gotten things done when people are starting to get in and get their coffee. It's funny we brought this up because there used to be a handful of us that would get here before 8 o'clock. And I think people have kind of caught on that it's quiet and you get work done. And so the last few weeks, now it's kind of, I'm like, so I need to push this a little bit earlier. I used to be the only one in my corner. We have kind of desks, rows of 6. And I used to be the only one on the row. Now the guys are getting there a little early, which is great. I mean, it's increasing productivity.
Are you good? And then also quitting early in the evening and say I take a walk in the sun or something like that?
Yeah, my thing is I always take a walk during lunch. I don't eat a big lunch. Mm-hmm. That's kind of for health reasons and for just stress reasons. I kind of into biohacking and longevity stuff. And one of my doctors was saying, 3 things people can easily cure is most people don't drink enough water.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't get enough, don't walk enough. We sit down all day and most people don't get enough sleep. So if you can take care of those 3 things, you're actually going to be relatively healthy. So every day at lunch, I'll usually get up and take about a 45-minute walk and usually get a smoothie or a protein shake or a juice. And, we're in New York, so it's it's amazing. It's there's the Empire State Building, there's Union Square. It never gets old. So it's great stuff, great things to look at. So I usually, I'll start at 7. My mornings are usually full of meetings, a lot of European meetings that I have with Paris, UK, Germany. And then I'll usually take a later lunch than most people as well. Admittedly, we also have a video game system hooked up on the giant screen. So every day around 4, I'll usually play a game or 2, sometimes 3 of FIFA.
FIFA?
Yeah. I hadn't played video games in a good probably 7-8 years, and I started here. And our CEO bought the gaming system itself for people to use, and I just got addicted. I play it. It's a daily thing. I will admit, I play. Cool. Yeah.
Is there anything you do for getting inspiration and all these ideas that you have?
I'm just a voracious reader. I have I'm a big RSS guy, so I use a app or I guess a website called Feedly. Mm-hmm. And I just put all of my news sources from whether it's my music stuff, security stuff, world affairs.
Can you name some? So, what are typical sources that you like to read?
have become like Wall Street Journal, I think, still really solid for big news journalism. Gosh, that's a great question. I follow a blog called Lawfare in the U.S., and essentially it's a legal take on U.S. national security and cybersecurity stuff, written by a lot of people who've been like the general counsel at the NSA, at Homeland Security. So they give you a legal take on why certain events are happening within the U.S. government. Follow a lot of like random music blogs, but I think I follow a lot of marketing blogs, even some of the music marketing blogs. I don't think you can just look for one source for inspiration. If you're just looking at tech stuff or cybersecurity stuff, you're going to be thinking like a tech cybersecurity guy. I think some of the greatest inspirations have come from people that haven't been directly involved kind of in, I think it was Amazon Prime. They had been suggested to Jeff Bezos by someone who wasn't a product guy. I could be wrong, but I think you just have to get, you know, an outside take. I'd say the study we released this week with Virginia Tech was it was based on this professor's just really academic study of passwords. I had some random security term tagged in my RSS and my alerts. It showed up and I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And I clicked his website and then he's like, hey, I have 61 million passwords that someone can use for research. Email me. And I think we were the only ones that emailed him. And I was like, hi, we would love these. And he's like, sure, have them. And it resulted in just a huge spike of coverage for us this week. I mean, we saw it across the UK, the US, Brazil, and everyone here is like, wow, this is incredible. But, you know, we don't get that if I'm not structured and organized and have these random security terms that I've seen kind of organized and into Feely.
Do you read?
Books?
Books. What is a book?
You know, it's a great question. I've become more like a long-form article reader. Mm. The last book I read was, I'm forgetting the name, it was written by a former Navy SEAL. This guy called Jocko, who has a really popular podcast.
Oh.
Yeah.
Also an early riser.
Yeah. Get up at 4. He has he tweets every day, I think at 4, of him in his gym, like doing a squat. But, I'm a big military history fan and I like to read about special operations forces. Very interested because they operate in kind of what I like to call a zero fail environment, meaning I don't execute my PR plan. We didn't get coverage or our competitor may get something. If you're not watching the back of your teammate out there, they're going to get shot and killed, and it may have a huge national security implication. So I love reading about how these guys operate and how they train and how meticulous they are, and try to translate that. And my takeaway from a lot of the books I've read, his was more on leadership and more of the tactical things. It's, you know, these guys, Navy SEALs, Delta Force, kind of British SAS units, you know, what they'll say is, you know, we don't do anything special. We're just the best at the fundamentals. So we practice the fundamentals and we're better at the fundamentals than everybody else is. I think that can translate to business. I'm a sports guy. I think it translates to sports as well.
What's your favorite sport?
I was a basketball player.
Cool. At college? You played at college?
I got burnt out in the youth. So I didn't play in college. I had a chance to essentially, you know, I was playing in tournaments year round from about age probably 10 or 11 straight to 18. And was just tired of it. Like it was just exhausted and I had other interests. But I play basketball. I don't watch it on television. I watch football and American football.
You don't follow the finals now?
I had to follow the finals every evening. Michael watches every evening.
I'm a big
evening.
Fan. I'm a really
It's hard when I look at it because I look at it as a player, right?
Yeah,
and
sure.
So I'm analyzing as a player, like how the game is moving. It's not entertaining for me. Whereas when I watch football, I'm a big Barcelona fan. Like I can enjoy it and just enjoy it as like the art of it, the spectacle. I'm watching basketball. I'm like, these two guys shouldn't be on the court. Like he's going to get a turnover. Like there's no reason he should be on the roster.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But the like back to the special operations guys, I just think the mastery of the fundamentals, I just loved it because I think we have these images in the media of them, you know, hopping out of like helicopters and these big guys that are doing crazy things. And they're like, you know what? No, we just sat at the range today for 8 hours shooting a pistol at a target, practicing how fast we're moving from like hip to holding position. And I think the same for business. It's everybody has these grand schemes and plans. It's like, make it simple. Like nobody wants a long meeting with a 20-point agenda. give me three key things we're going to talk about. I think you trust the people around you as well. You know, you don't need to share all of your information and accomplishments. It's like, if you have a question, like if your team's smart enough, they're going to ask the question, you know, I guess micromanaging and too much information, too much data, data overload is a big problem now for me.
Awesome. That was
amazing.
Quite a ride.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Scott, for all the insights. And thanks for hosting us.
Great. Thank you.